in an interest to get things moving back, and we have a couple other plenary sessions we want to get to, we will go ahead and start the oral abstracts as people are filtering in. So for those of you that I have not had the chance to meet, my name is Vedant Gupta from the University of Kentucky, and this is probably one of my favorite sessions to do. It's an opportunity for some of our trainees to really showcase the work that they're doing, and we have two oral presentations to give. Again, in the interest of time, what I'm probably going to do is cut out the question and answer session component to it, but I have told the presenters to just be available afterwards if people have questions and they can ask. And so we have two oral presentations to give. The first one that we have is from one of our pediatric residents at the University of Louisville, Josh Lee. He's going to be talking about evaluation of invasively measured pressures and echocardiographic measures of diastolic function in children with Fontan circulation.
Yep. Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Lee. I'm a second-year pediatrics resident at the University of Louisville and Norton Children's Hospital. So I'm excited to share my project. It's called Evaluation of Invasively Measured Pressures and Echocardiographic Measures of Diastolic Dysfunction in Children with Fontan. So I have no relevant financial disclosures. So very briefly, the Fontan procedure is the final step in a series of palliative surgeries for patients with single ventricles. It results in the vena cava being directly connected to the pulmonary arteries while bypassing the ventricles, and this often leads to congestion upstream as well as downstream effects such as a preload starved ventricle. Despite improvements in morbidity and mortality, ongoing efforts to improve Fontan outcomes have been largely unsuccessful. They have primarily focused on the pulmonary arteries as well as systolic dysfunction. However, many patients neither have evidence of overt systolic dysfunction or evidence of reversible pulmonary endothelial dysfunction. On the other hand, as our understanding of the Fontan circulation has improved, diastolic dysfunction has likely remained an under-recognized cause of Fontan failure. In fact, the pediatric heart Fontan cross-sectional study identified 72% of patients having evidence of abnormal diastolic dysfunction with normal ejection fraction. However, methods for detecting diastolic dysfunction are still evolving. Echocardiograms are not well established, and invasive hemodynamic evaluations are frequently unrevealing in the single ventricle population. Thus, improved diagnostic criteria are necessary. So in our study, we wanted to see if any echocardiographic measures of diastolic dysfunction would correlate with any invasively measured pressures. However, we also wanted to do this before and after fluid expansion. Up to 40% of Fontan patients are shown to have evidence of occult diastolic dysfunction that wasn't found on routine heart catheterization. So we felt like this would be an important group to include. In addition, we wanted to assess any pressure changes in the Fontan circulation following volume expansion. We hypothesized, since the pulmonary arteries are considered the primary determinant of the failing Fontan, that it would primarily occur there. And lastly, we wanted to identify if any clinical factors such as age, gender, type of ventricle, type of Fontan, you know, presence of fenestration would be associated with diastolic dysfunction. So we conducted a retrospective chart review. Any patients who had a Fontan 5 years or under were excluded from our study. Fontan patients had to have an echo within 6 months of right heart catheterization. And we defined diastolic dysfunction as a post-bolus volume of at least 15, or if it was under 15, it had to be at least 20% increase from baseline with a pressure of at least 12. And with the help of our statisticians, we were able to use the Mann-Whitney U-test, Fisher's exact, and Spearman's row where appropriate. So this is a slide of our demographic data. Overall, we were able to have 20 patients in total, 10 which had diastolic dysfunction, 10 which did not. Average age was 15 years old, and 40% were females. Of all the clinical data, duration of Fontan to catheterization was significantly correlated with increasing ventricular and diastolic pressure. However, in our study, there was no association with ventricular morphology, type of Fontan, presence of fenestration, or any adverse outcomes. This is a table of the echo data that we collected. Overall, two values stood out, deceleration time and lateral ETE prime. So an elevated deceleration time and an increased lateral EDE prime were significantly increased in patients who qualified for diastolic dysfunction compared to patients who did not have diastolic dysfunction. And lastly, this is a table of the catheterized data that we were able to obtain. So there were significant increases in Fontan pressure, pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, and ventricular end diastolic pressure after fluid expansion. And this was both in patients with diastolic dysfunction and patients without. However, there was no significant increases in transpulmonary gradient or pulmonary vascular resistance, which suggests that there may be a multi-level of dysfunction in this circulation. And lastly, patients with diastolic dysfunction were independently associated with a decrease in cardiac index after fluid expansion. Some limitations to our studies. Overall, the results were statistically significant. However, we did have a small number of patients. And there were insufficient numbers to analyze the impact of ventricular type, morphology, and several other clinical factors in our data. And overall, patients with different anatomic diagnoses and ventricular morphology may have affected the Doppler echo values. So conclusions, diastolic dysfunction in patients with a Fontan circulation was associated with changes in lateral EDE prime and deceleration time. Abnormal diastolic dysfunction was independently associated with a lower cardiac index, and this is regardless of pulmonary vascular resistance or transpulmonary gradient. And lastly, large multi-center studies are needed to better define invasive and non-invasive measures of diastolic dysfunction. Resources, and then questions.
Thank you. And again, as I'd mentioned earlier, in an effort to get through the presentations, I'm going to go on to the next presentation. But Josh and Ranjan Banerjee, our next presenter, will be available if you have questions about their specific projects. So the next presenter is one of our third-year fellows at the University of Kentucky, Ranjan Banerjee. He's going to be talking about changes in ventricular arterial coupling and valvular arterial impedance in patients when transcatheter aortic valve implantations for severe aortic stenosis.
Thanks. Hey, everyone. Like Dr. Gupta said, my name is Ranjan. I'm a third-year general cardiology fellow at UK, and my project looked at changes in ventricular arterial coupling and valvular arterial impedance in patients with who have undergone TAVI for severe aortic stenosis. So, quick background, the left ventricle in severe AS undergoes compensatory changes, which initially is a good adaptive mechanism, but over time leads to the onset of fibrosis via multiple mechanisms and the onset of systolic-diastolic dysfunction, and eventually the patients present with heart failure symptoms. And we know from work done by Dr. Braunwald many decades ago now that the onset of symptoms associated with severe AS is a poor prognostic sign. Now, fortunately, aortic valve replacement has tempered a lot of this outcome, and in the past decade or so, TAVI has emerged as a viable option for many patients who previously could not go aortic valve replacement for severe AS. Current guidelines recommend aortic valve replacement in patients with severe aortic stenosis and who develop symptoms or who are asymptomatic and have a LV ejection fraction of less than 50%. However, there's also data out there to suggest that maybe this 50% cutoff may be too low and we're getting to some of these patients too late, as well as data to suggest that there are indices of LV function, such as global longitudinal strain, that decrease before we see a decline in ejection fraction. So one thought is, you know, maybe there are other indices of LV function that we can assess in the setting of severe AS that would help us better identify patients who might benefit from TAVI. So one way to do this is by looking at how the ventricle and the aorta interact with each other instead of the left ventricle in isolation. So the way we do this is by looking at the ventricular arterial coupling ratio, which is represented by the end. It's represented by the effective arterial elastance designated by E sub A, which is the index of afterload, And the ratio of that to the end systolic elastance, E sub ES, which is a load-independent measure of contractility. Both of these variables can be derived from pressure volume loops, which previously required invasive measurements in the cath lab and was very cumbersome, but over the past several years, some groups have developed non-invasive measures and ways to derive both of these variables that correlate very well with invasive measurements. Speaking about the end systolic elastance, the slope of the end systolic pressure volume relationship correlates with contractility, with an increase in slope representing increased contractile states. And looking at the index of afterload, E sub A, there's another variable out there called the valvular arterial impedance, which, unlike E sub A, takes into account the total load seen by the left ventricle. So not only the systolic blood pressure, but also the load of the stenotic aortic valve. And studies in severe aortic stenosis looking at valvular arterial impedance have stratified these patients into low, moderate, and high impedances based on those criteria there, which correlate with mortality. So higher impedance leads to higher mortality. So which leads us to our study. So the rationale behind our study from a kind of a 10,000 foot view is describing how the LV and the systemic vasculature interact with each other in severe AS may better identify patients who would better benefit from TAVI. And the objectives of this particular study were to describe the changes in the ventricular arterial coupling ratio and the valvular arterial impedance before and after TAVI in patients with severe aortic stenosis. So how do we do this? This was a retrospective cohort study. We looked at 100 patients that were randomly chosen from the database of all TAVIs done at our institution since 2012. We looked at their pre and post TAVI transthoracic echocardiograms as well as their pre-TAVI CTs. And using those non-invasive methods we touched on before, we were able to calculate both the valvular arterial impedance and the ventricular arterial coupling ratio. We used the mean values of each of these measurements, and we compared them using a t-test using a p-value of 0.05 as a threshold of significance. So results were fairly interesting. So starting with the valvular arterial impedance denoted by ZVA on that table there, we saw that there was a statistically significant decrease in impedance, which was likely driven by a statistically significant decrease in the mean gradient across the aortic valve, as you might expect in patients undergoing TAVI for severe AS. However, the stroke volume didn't change before and after TAVI, but the systolic blood pressure went up. So before TAVI, systolic blood pressure was uncontrolled at 133 millimeters of mercury. After TAVI, it actually went up to 144. So what this suggests is, although the impedance did decrease from the severe range to the moderate range, the amount of decrease that it could have had was offset by a concurrent increase in systolic blood pressure. Now, looking at measures of ventricular arterial coupling, we see that there was a significant decrease in E sub ES, which is a measure of contractility, as well as a significant increase in E sub A, which is the index of afterload. Now, this makes sense because we know that the systolic blood pressure increased after following the valve replacement. Overall, this led to a deterioration in the coupling ratio, E sub A over E sub ES, after TAVI. This was somewhat surprising. It's not really what we expected based on what we would expect after valve replacement. But if we look at measures of LV contractile function independent of the arterial system, there's evidence to suggest that the contractile function of the LV actually improved. So one way we can do this, based on the figure on the left there, is by constructing a end systolic pressure volume relationship for each contractile state, post-TAVI and pre-TAVI. And we can do this because we know that the derivation of the ventricular arterial coupling ratio depends on the fact that the ESPVR line is always linear. And actually, in vivo studies, we've shown that, has been shown that this doesn't hold true for contractile states. So at extremes of contractility, the ESPVR line is actually nonlinear. So we can derive independent ESPVR lines pre and post TAVI, and what it shows is that the line shifts to the left, which suggests that there's increased contractility because you're able to achieve higher pressures for the same volume. Also, another way to look at this would be to look at what happens to the end-systolic volume if we assume that the end-systolic pressure is fixed? In our case, we choose an end-systolic pressure of 100, and we see that the mean values of the end-systolic volume decrease from pre to post-TAVI. Again, that would suggest that the contractility might improve after TAVI. So how do we reconcile this? If we stratify everything, our data with by ejection fraction, we see that the results that we just discussed are really only applicable to LV ejection fractions of greater than 50%. So on that bottom row there, if your LVEF is greater than 50%, you have a significant decrease in LV elastance, so a significant increase in arterial elastance, and a deterioration of the ratio. However, looking at the LV ejection fraction of less than 40%, none of the values were significant there. So overall, what does this mean? So non-invasive echocardiography was useful in demonstrating an improvement in LV contractile function following TAVI using the adjusted end-systolic pressure volume relationship and the LV end-systolic volume at a assumed LV end-systolic pressure of 100 millimeters mercury. However, looking at the LV elastance, that behaved differently, and unexpectedly, it decreased with an associated increase in arterial elastance, overall leading to a worsening of coupling between the LVA and aorta. So those number one and two are somewhat discordant, right? Because LV elastance is a measure of contractility, but so are those other two measures in one. Overall, this suggests that a higher arterial elastance adversely impacts LV elastance, basically meaning our blood pressure in our population is poorly controlled, and this is affecting both how much afterload the LV has to pump against, but also how much improvement in contractile function we're seeing in our patients after TAVI, because overall the interaction between the two are deteriorating. Elevated systemic arterial stiffness from persistent hypertension likely tempers some benefit that we're seeing with the TAVI. And highlights the need to optimize blood pressure control before and after transcatheter aortic valve implantation. So some limitations of our study, this was a small sample size. It was 100 patients that were randomly chosen, and then the subgroup, some of the subgroup analysis that we did by ejection fraction was limited to 10 patients in the group less than 40% and 76 in the group greater than 50%. So single center study is also a retrospective study, which opens us up to confounding variables that we can't control for. So future investigations, things that we're working on right now is looking at what effect do comorbid conditions have on the changes in ventricular arterial coupling and valval arterial impedance. We're also looking at changes in diastolic function following TAVI, and does that have any correlate with what we're seeing with VAC and ZVA? And then eventually, the hope is that we'll be able to look at clinical outcomes. Do changes in a certain direction of a certain magnitude in those variables have any effect on rehospitalizations and mortality? That's it. Thank you.
So thank you to both of the presenters. This is a great opportunity to really highlight some of the work that our trainees are doing. The poster sessions are a reflection of that, so we encourage everybody to please take some time, provide feedback for the trainees as they're doing this, really recognize some great science that's happening in the Commonwealth right now. So thank you, everyone.